that last possession. The song, she's discussing one between mother and son, continues, quoting the song, "A true woman carries upon her the burden of shame of the entire world. Her modesty is her dharma, that is, her rule of conduct, life's imperative." End of song quote. It ends with an ungendered aspiration, quote, "Those who have lived with dignity will die with dignity too." But Radha does not know how precariously close she is to losing even this last possession. Quote, "This is not lyric, but a lecture. Did you find it difficult to set these rhetorical sentences to melody?" I asked when I interviewed Naushad, the composer. In both Hindu and Islamic religious traditions, songs are discursive or narrative, and not merely lyrical. They tell stories, discuss ethical and philosophical issues. Quote, "This was not unusual for me," Naushad replied. "It can be described as a melodious way of rendering a discourse, not the same as a pure song." Close quote. This second edition now opens with a 3-page introduction, where the writer assesses the film's still global appeal, makes a closer examination of the film and its first version, portrays the role of money in the industry's culture, explains why she picked this particular cover art, and the film's philosophy of ruralism and family ties. Mother India is a version of Arat from 1940 and was remade in 1971 as Bangaru. Though a global art house hit, the film and its two successors were not as popular at home, and Nargis herself later criticized the film as politically backward. We've been talking about the BFI monograph Mother India by Gayatri Chatterjee, now in a second edition. Again, thanks for listening to Community Radio, KBOO Portland. Film at 11 will be back next Friday, so until then, keep watching the screens.
This is KBOO Portland, volunteer-powered community radio.
KBOO News is proud to present our 2022 Citizens Agenda Survey, and we want to hear your thoughts as we approach the midterm election. What do you want candidates to be talking about as they compete for votes? Let us know, and you can be entered into a sweepstakes to win a $50 Visa gift card as a thank you. Plus, it will help our volunteer reporters cover the election with the info that you need to know. Find the survey online at bit.ly/KBOO-survey. That's KBOO's 2022 Citizens Agenda Survey, available online through September 25th at bit.ly/KBOO-survey.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's show, we celebrate the 40th anniversary of Banned Books Week. We'll hear from four expert guests, the coordinator of the Banned Books Week Coalition, a student activist in Texas, the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, and the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. All today on the Project Censored Show. Stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. This week on the Project Censored Show, it's our annual Banned Books Week program. Listeners of the program know that Project Censored has been a co-sponsor with many other fascinating and wonderful organizations. The forces behind Banned Books Week and the Banned Books Week Coalition, working in conjunction with the American Library Association. This year marks 40 years now since Banned Books Week was started. 1982 was the launch date. Banned Books Week, again, if you don't know, is an annual event celebrating the freedom to read. It's not celebrating censorship. It's, in fact, an effort to combat it. And again, in 1982, Banned Books Week was launched as a response to a sudden surge in the number of challenges to books in schools, bookstores, and libraries. Well, 40 years later, we're seeing another surge in the numbers of these challenges. And Banned Books Week, held the last week of September, right around the start of the school year, highlights the value of free and open access to information. You can see why Project Censored is so interested in the Banned Books Week Coalition and the great work that they do, also in conjunction with the National Coalition Against Censorship. Banned Books Week brings together the entire book community, librarians, booksellers, publishers, journalists, teachers, readers of all types, in shared support of the freedom to seek and to express ideas, even those some consider unorthodox or unpopular. We have several great guests, so please tune in for the hour. Right now, our first guest is Betsy Gomez. Betsy is the Banned Books Week Coalition coordinator. So if you want to see what herding cats can look like, Betsy is certainly an expert. The coalition is a fantastic group of free thinkers and supporters of the First Amendment and the rights of free expression. Betsy Gomez, welcome to the program.
Thank you for the warm welcome, Mickey.
It is fantastic to have you with us this year. You have always helped coordinate and get people to come on our show every year, and you do such amazing outreach work around Banned Books Week. That's coming up. It starts September 18th. What is the theme for Banned Books Week this year, Betsy?
The theme for Banned Books Week is Books Unite Us, Censorship Divides Us.
So the ALA, the American Library Association, releases its list of most challenged books. They do that in the spring. Many of us have been very busy this past year because there has been a rather extraordinary uptick in challenges to books. PEN America also did a report not long ago that found well over 1,000 books were challenged just from the fall of 2021 to the spring of 2022, and according to their site and their study, 467 titles that included protagonists or prominent secondary characters who were people of color, that's 41%, 247 titles, or 22%, directly addressed issues of race and racism, 379 titles, 33%, explicitly address LGBTQ plus themes, or have protagonists or prominent secondary characters who are LGBTQ+. And of course, we know too that graphic books have an extraordinary tendency to be targets of censorship campaigns. So Betsy Gomez, tell us about some of the troubling themes we see behind book challenges this past year.
ALA tracked challenges to, I believe, was almost 1,600 books in 2021. And on their top 10 list, most of the books on the top 10 list were challenged over LGBTQ content. And that is an ongoing theme, even as the year has gone on. What we're seeing is traditionally it's like one or two books get challenged at a time. We're seeing entire lists of books. We're seeing things like the Krause list in Texas, which has 850 books on it. And most of those deal with LGBTQ themes or racial diversity and police violence. So we've got a trend of organized attempts to remove entire series of books, entire shelves, effectively, of content that deals with diverse voices and underrepresented voices. And it's disturbing. It's led by a minority of people who are engaging with libraries and schools. But what's terrifying is a lot of schools and libraries are taking action based on these complaints. They're letting a small handful of people make these decisions about what they carry. And additionally, we have legislative attempts to stifle speech. Florida in particular is an example with the Don't Say Gay bill and the Stop Woke Act. And so we have a pretty terrifying environment, especially for teachers and librarians who are trying to navigate these laws and these attempts to ban entire themes of material.
And in the process, Betsy Gomez, of banning entire shelves, as you say, and lists These are directly connected with marginalized communities, with marginalized demographics of people in our society. And we're just getting through the COVID pandemic, and teachers, students have been under extraordinary pressures and challenges. And now on top of it all, we see, particularly by the right, weaponization, if you will, right? A weaponization of things like critical race theory that most people haven't even heard of, let alone had been taught in K-12, which is pretty extraordinary. You mentioned these laws, these bills. There have been at least 137 educational gag bills that have been introduced in the past year. This is pretty extraordinary. This is a full frontal assault. And again, you mentioned this, not by a majority, but by a well-funded or well-heeled, very vocal minority of people that are trying to, well, in their estimation, they say they're trying to, quote, protect children from what exactly, Betsy?
The language they are using is about protecting children, but they're also using the language of parents' rights. And parents do have rights to make decisions for their own children. And no one is saying they don't have that right. But what we're seeing is a number of people are using parents' rights as an argument for removing these materials because parents have right to demand removal. And they argue that their rights are more important than the expertise of educators who understand how to appropriately shelve these materials, understand their audiences, and have an obligation to meet the needs of a diverse group of people. So this minority that's using parents' rights as an argument is actually in many ways violating the parental rights of other members of the community, because there are a lot of parents who want this material to be available. One of the things we've seen more recently is these parents are starting to engage in protest against the people who are trying to censor books, which is heartening, but it's still going to be a long fight because we're also, in addition to people showing up at board meetings, we also have a number of people who are using the voting process, the election process, to replace school boards and library boards and boards of trustees with individuals who are more inclined to censor materials.
I'm glad you pointed that out, Betsy Gomez. Because especially when we're talking about these challenges in schools, K-12 particularly, it's often students that are on the front line blowing the whistle, students that are standing up for their rights to read and to be taught freely. Later in the program, we'll be talking to Cameron Samuels, the first honorary youth chair, I believe, for Banned Books Week Coalition. So we'll get to hear about that case in particular in Texas. That's just one riveting example. Can you talk a little bit about a couple other examples of how it's important to recognize that young people are really at the forefront of standing up against censorship?
Absolutely. And the young people have been one of the most successful forces in this fight. Cameron started going to the Katy school board meetings and was the only student for the longest time protesting censorship in that community. And they were able to engage more students and more parents in the protests there. We saw it in New York, Pennsylvania, when they tried to stymie a diversity, equity, inclusion program, and the students there engaged and protested, and the school board backed down from their plans. So we've seen it in multiple locations around the country. And, you know, it's interesting because often the people who are trying to censor these books are like, we're trying to protect the kids. My kid shouldn't have to see this. No kid should have to see this. And they're not actually talking to the kids. They're not talking to the students. And the students will be the first ones to tell you, no, we want this material to be available. I may not read it, but some of my classmates might. You know, it's part of this moral panic that we seem to go through occasionally when it comes to anything that teens and kids are interested in, but we're not actually involving them in the conversation. And so it's so essential to make sure that they're part of this. And it's so essential to listen to them, because if we're going to really address their interests and their needs, they need to have a role in the conversation.
Absolutely. And again, we're speaking with Betsy Gomez, bannedbooksweek.org. Betsy is the coordinator for the Banned Books Week Coalition, of which Project Censored is a small part, but we are proud supporters of Banned Books Week. We are, of course, supporters of the American Library Association. Betsy Gomez, can you talk a little bit about some of the work that you're doing with ALA this year?
In my role as the Banned Books Week Coalition Coordinator, I do a lot of programming for Banned Books Week, and I recently joined ALA's Office for Intellectual Freedom to help them with their program as well. So between the two organizations, I am working on several virtual programs that support librarians, that support students and youth, and that feature a lot of authors who have either been censored or have taken a very vocal stance against censorship. people can follow the Banned Books Week website, bannedbooksweek.org, go to the events page and find out about some of these events. Between the coalition and OIF, I'm working on 7 or 8 events, and there are organizations within the coalition that are also going to be working on a lot of events. So we're doing everything we can to get resources, information out there.
Indeed. We're actually doing an event at my college, Diablo Valley College, Thursday the 15th. It'll be with you and Nico Perino of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, Nolan Higdon, and we'll be talking about the importance of academic freedom, Banned Books Week. You're all really well organized when it comes to sharing resources for what you can do, whether you're a teacher, a librarian, a student, a concerned community member, a parent yourself. Can you talk a little bit about some of the resources you have available so people can understand that anybody can roll up their sleeves and get involved in the fight against censorship?
I think it's essential that people understand they're not alone in this fight, that there are lots of organizations that are available to help them. And we do have a contacts page on the website that you can reach out to the organizations individually. I think it's also essential that we communicate with each other. If you see censorship happening in your community, even if it resolves favorably, it's important to let organizations know that it's happening so that we can track it and understand the patterns behind it. As far as resources go, ALA has tons of resources on development plans, on challenge reaction plans. There are a number of organizations within the coalition who have resources to help you develop plans to deal with censorship. And we're also prepared to help you deal with situations when they happen. When you get a request to remove books, we are ready to provide resources to respond to that advice. And on the rare occasion, many of the organizations within the coalition have provided legal support and paid for legal representation.
That's, again, very important. And Betsy Gomez, I want to take a moment to just read this, because I think it's really important for our listeners to comprehend the broad nature of support that Banned Books Week has. Again, it's an annual celebration of the freedom to read, and the event is sponsored by a coalition of organizations dedicated to free expression, including the American Booksellers for Free Expression, the American Library Association, American Society of Journalists and Authors, Amnesty International USA, Association of University Presses, Authors Guild, Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, the FIRE, Freedom to Read Foundation, GLAAD, Index on Censorship, National Book Foundation, the National Coalition Against Censorship, National Council of Teachers of English, PEN America, People for the American Way Foundation, PFLAG, and of course Project Censored. It's endorsed by the Center for the Book in the Library of Congress, and Banned Books Week also receives support from HarperCollins Publishers and Penguin Random House that also have amazing resources at their page. The Banned Books Week Coalition resources and team, what a powerhouse of information and support for First Amendment rights, the rights to free expression. Betsy Gomez, anywhere people can find out more or follow your work or get in touch?
I highly recommend everybody visit bannedbooksweek.org for the latest information. We're going to have some events up and posted and advertised soon. If you have an event that you're hosting, you can add it to our events calendar, bannedbooksweek.org/events. We have a form there that you can fill out. And finally, I just want to send a message out to everybody who's confronting this censorship. The problem is not you. The problem is not your interests. It's not the books you like to read. The problem is a minority of voices that wants to remove this material. And we're here to support you. And we're going to do everything we can to keep the censorship from happening.
Banned Books Week, September 18 to 24. Betsy Gomez, thank you so much for joining us on the Project Censored show today.
Thank you.
Stay tuned for the rest of the program. We've got multiple other guests talking about Banned Books Week and academic freedom. You're listening to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. This week, we're talking all about Banned Books Week, and we are featuring folks affiliated with the Banned Books Week Coalition. We have several guests. Our next guest is a young person who did amazing things this past year, courageous things, in Texas. We're joined by Cameron Samuels, who was a senior last year at the Katy Independent School District, has graduated and since gone on to university. Samuels has been named the first ever youth honorary chair of Banned Books Week, and that's celebrated, by the way, September 18 to 24. Banned Books Week is not the celebration of banning, challenging, and censoring books. It's rather a week that brings awareness to the many, many efforts that go on around the United States to ban books, challenge books, and prevent students, young people, and the public in general from reading diverse viewpoints. And at Project Censored, we've been sponsors of Banned Books Week for quite a long time. We're also part of the National Coalition Against Censorship, and we do our annual show to showcase, to highlight Banned Books Week. And this year, we've even done a couple of Banned Books Week shows in between Banned Books Week, because there's been an extraordinary uptick in challenges to books this past year. And Cameron Samuels is joining us now to tell us about, they're going to join us to tell us about the efforts they made, the activism that they participated in the state of Texas over a series of efforts to ban books. So Cameron Samuels, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Happy to be here.
And here you are, first ever Youth Honorary Chair of Banned Books Week. Thank you so much for all the important work that you're doing fighting censorship. Let's tell the story, Cameron, to tell folks the story of what happened in your senior year in your school.
During my senior year in the Katy Independent School District in Texas, I saw that our marginalized identities of this diverse school district had been targeted at an unprecedented rate. In the beginning of the year, we saw that books were being removed from school libraries. And this was not surprising per se to me, but it was really disappointing to see that a school district I had grown up in from kindergarten, that is a majority minority school district, has such a diverse student population, and we value success in ourselves and value the connections that we make between each other. But yet we were seeing that the people in power in the district were seeking to close off perspectives they disagreed with and ban books that touched upon race and LGBTQ identities.
Cameron, can you talk to us about when these challenges began that you can recollect? And can you even mention maybe a couple of the titles? Of course, the American Library Association released a list in the spring of the top 10 books, topping them, of course, Genderqueer, Maya Kababe. That was one of the things we were calling attention to. And again, the kind of books that are being attacked are often ones that depict people from diverse perspectives, LGBTQIA plus community, people of color. Can you tell us a little bit about how you remember this beginning and what stirred you to action? Cameron Samuels.
At the beginning of this past school year, we saw that in headlines across the country, there were many schools involved in book banning. And this started to tumble forward in Katy, especially in September, October of 2021. And one of the books that were first removed here was New Kid by Jerry Craft. And that book I had read and saw absolutely no reason for it to be banned. It's a children's book talking about how we can value each other and not have these stereotypes and microaggressions that we see on an everyday basis in Texas and across the nation. But yet it was for that very reason that it made white people feel uncomfortable, and this book was removed. An author visit was canceled because parents in the district said that the book and the author taught critical race theory and that had no place in schools. And it just kept tumbling forward afterward. And there were, by January, 10 books completely removed and more than 30 books removed in various grades. And I felt like there was no other way to respond to this than to speak up. And I did that at the November school board meeting this past year, and I spoke every month thereafter. And we saw that it was parents who were calling for books to be banned, while it was students like me, the only student that spoke in November, but then we had many students begin to speak later in the year. And we were the ones calling for these books to remain in libraries. We saw that this wasn't enough because the board was listening to the parents, not the students who they represent as well and who their policies directly affect on an everyday basis, but they were listening to the parents and not us. We needed a voice at the table. And one thing we did to build our power was organize book distributions in high schools across the district. We distributed eventually more than 700 books in the spring. It was a one-week effort in February entitled Freedom Week, the freedom to read, so a play on word with freedom and reading. And we distributed those books. Student organizers at each of these high schools put these events together after school. And this made waves in the district. And we started to soon see that books were put back on shelves. Committees reconsidered their reviews and put these books back. We still saw more books be banned, but at least it slowed and it didn't keep skyrocketing like it had at unprecedented rates.
Cameron, that's an amazing story, and it's also a fantastic example of how standing up for community values that are about diversity and free expression, in the face of that kind of adversity, you and your peers at the school gradually began to make more noise. Did you find allies among your librarian faculty or English faculty?
This is a challenging time for educators in our country, especially librarians, because these policies are taking a hit at libraries, and we haven't been able to see librarians speak up for themselves. That has been a huge difficulty. We can say about how these educators have responded, because in reality, they haven't been able to. If they speak out, they're risking losing their jobs, such as we've seen in Louisiana recently, how many librarians there have been under attack, have been fired for supporting efforts against book banning. And this is the very thing that we should not be seeing, because this is not only censorship of their voice, but it is harmful to their life. These educators have families, and it's already a tough job. We must support librarians, educators.
Well, Cameron Samuels, I could not agree more with you and with that statement. And it's heartening to see people of any age stand up for the right to read and expression. It's particularly so to see young people such as yourself. You're in vulnerable positions as well when you're a student in high school. They don't have the same rights as college students. And I think that's preposterous, but I think your experience, you know that there are certain rules and restrictions that apply to K-12 students. And you're speaking out against these actions may not make you popular in your community. Any pushback or anything that you overcame along the way?
Texas is a battleground currently. It is not just a conservative state. It is a battleground because Texas is much more diverse than you think in viewpoints too, because we are struggling. There are many people struggling in Texas, and it is not a lost cause and should not be treated that way. I, as a student, have seen that myself and my peers have had to face the brunt of conservative policies, especially censorship in our classrooms, in our libraries, and this censorship of our identities is only harming us. We can't uphold this unjust status quo any longer. And when we do speak out, there has been a lot of backlash. We had parents tried to shut us down when we distributed books, trying to interfere in our distributions, confronting us at school board meetings. And this disrespect and this lack of compassion is what we need to change in the other direction. We have to shape a community of compassion and leave that as our legacy. And we can't just let Texas be Texas and allow people to continue making harmful policies.
Well, and Cameron, as you may or may not know, Texas is one of the leading publishers of school textbooks. And so you're so on point by talking about Texas as a battleground state, because the politics of Texas and who controls certain things there. It also has an impact on the publishing industry, the kind of views that get into more mainstreamed textbooks, which makes it even more important to have diverse selections in school libraries and school curricula. So in high school, Cameron Samuels, did you hear any of your teachers talking directly about critical race theory, per se? I mean, did you have people trying to teach or indoctrinate you in the classroom?
Absolutely not. Critical race theory has not been taught in Texas or anywhere in high schools, in middle schools, or even elementary schools. That is simply a lie blown out of proportion of people who are seeking to gain power to push their narrative of conservatism, of seeking to close off these perspectives they disagree with, even when it is objectively what we need to know. Inclusion and equity is what we need. And using critical race theory as a scare tactic is fear-mongering. And it is how many school board electees have won their elections across the state of Texas. In KDISD and many districts across the state, that was one of the top issues, if not the number one issue, of the school board races in May. And we are seeing that once again. It is the marginalized communities who are harmed when their culture, their identities are thrown around in political discourse, when certain people are trying to gain power, gain voters, gain the ability to choose what students can and cannot learn about. And that is institutionally dividing our communities further and not giving students the resources they need to affirm their identities, to become successful people who are confident and who are supported.
Cameron Samuels, we have to wrap up this segment here in a minute, but I had one more thing I wanted to ask you now that you are off at university, if I might, and if you're comfortable saying so, what are you interested in studying, and how is being this youth honorary chair for Banned Books Week, how's that following you on or off campus with anything that you're doing this fall?
I have to say that I'm definitely not letting advocacy leave my side, because our voices are so powerful, and we can't let them be censored. We can't let other people speak for us. As young people, we have to have our voice and build power amongst us. And so that's what I hope to study more and become engaged more in now. And with Banned Books Week coming up this month, I hope that each of you listening here are going to get involved, either by participating in an event. You can visit the website to see the calendar of events. There might be some local ones in your community, also some virtual events online that you can attend. And hopefully you can start getting involved in your state legislatures and in your local school districts to advocate for policies that will support students and support educators.
Cameron Samuels, thank you so much for joining us on the Project Censored Show today. Thank you, too, for your stance against censorship, for the right to read. Certainly wish you all the best.
Thank you so much.
And that was my conversation with Cameron Samuels. Up next on the program, we welcome Jordan Smith from the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. We'll continue talking about all things Banned Books Week on the Project Censored Show after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we continue our theme for Banned Books Week. You can go to bannedbooksweek.org. We are delighted to have on the program Jordan Smith, freelance copy editor, also digital editor at the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. We have had folks from the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund on the program before. You can learn more at cbldf.org. And Jordan Smith, thanks so much for joining us today on the Project Censored Show.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Certainly, Comic Book Legal Defense Fund has a really fascinating history protecting a medium that's been under attack for decades. In fact, going back to the 50s or even earlier, comic books, graphic journalism, graphic works have come a long, long way in terms of literary respectability, and you can talk about that. But in other senses, people still kind of see comics as an easy target to censor ideas. So Jordan Smith, talk a little bit about your work.
We've been around since around 86, originally started by Dennis Kitchen. He raised money to defend a comic shop manager at Friendly Frank's, who's charged with distributing obscenity through the comics. So with the money that was raised in his defense that was left over, the fund was started with that. So when the fund first started out, it was doing a lot of protecting retailers. But as the landscape changed, we stopped having to go to court as much. It started being a lot of writing letters about free speech. And it seems like we've, in the last several years, we've entered an era where things are leaning a little bit more towards going to court. We're seeing not so much that our focus is protecting retailers, which is something that we still do, but a lot of the focus is now on schools, school libraries, and public libraries, where books are being attacked the most and graphic novels are being attacked. And specifically, it's identity censorship, which is graphic novels that are either written by or focus on characters from BIPOC or LGBTQ plus communities.
Can you talk to us about some of the main texts? Earlier this year, I did a panel with Maya Kababe around genderqueer. That's a classic example of what you were just talking about books that have been targeted. Can you talk about some of these and maybe even some of the activism you've been doing around them, even at places like Comic-Con and so forth? Jordan Smith.
It was really interesting. We were just at San Diego Comic-Con in July, and we had as our booth sort of a library of banned books. We had books on display, opened up to the, you know, offending pages of these graphic novels. And as the convention was going on, people were walking by and they're like, why are these books out? Why are these books out? It's like, well, these books have been banned or challenged in various places throughout our country. And people were shocked. They're like, well, why? Like, I've read this. Why is this banned? And it was things like Drama by Rita Telgemeier, Genderqueer by Maya Kobe, who you just mentioned, Persepolis. I think that was multiple times. There was two different occasions during the convention when people walked up to me and they were like really questioning me why Persepolis had been challenged in our country. And, you know, I could tell that they were very moved. They're like, this is my family story. I'm glad that you have this here and you're fighting to keep this here. So some of the work we've done recently, one of the examples is our interim director, Jeff Trexler, was co-counsel for genderqueer in Virginia Beach. Thankfully, the judge threw the obscenity case out. So that's one of the things we do is we can either refer people or represent them in court when things like obscenity charges come up.
So Jordan Smith, can you talk also a little bit about the history? You know, comic books have long just been targets of various groups in our society, whether because they believe that they're written for kids or children, which certainly isn't always the case. There's no shortage of examples in our history of how comics have often been on the front line of censorship battles or free expression battles. Can you talk a little bit about that, and what is it about it that attracts censors to these kinds of works?
We've had a lot of great turnover and thought about comics. There are so many librarians and teachers who back comics and see them as the literary tools that they are. There's so many different ways to learn, and they found that comics are fulfilling one of those different ways to learn in the best possible ways. But because comics are so powerful, they're good at relaying complex ideas in very short matters of time. That also makes them more susceptible to attacks. The visual nature of them makes them easy to attack. If we look at what's been going on the last couple of years, you know, we live in such a visual society. People are scrolling social media, and some of these original attacks happened when someone realized that they could take pictures of a graphic novel out of context, misconstrue what's happening in the graphic novel, and put it online, get likes, it goes viral. People aren't as into nuanced conversations in social media. And so it's getting retweeted with more misinformation, more misconstruing of what we're seeing. So we're getting these singular panels out of context being plastered everywhere. It also makes it easier to, the example of something like identity censorship, it makes it easier to target because you can just pick up a book and flip through the graphic novel and find things that you object to. Whereas a book, you have to engage more with the material. You have to be reading it.
You hit the nail on the head there for me for a minute, Jordan. You have to actually have read it. And like you said, it's easier to pick up a graphic book, a comic, see something that's startling or out of the ordinary for someone and react to it without context, without understanding it or even trying to. Whereas more traditional text, narrative text, over and over, you confront people and talk to people who want to ban books, challenge books, keep books out of people's hands. You say, well, have you actually read it? And the common response is, well, no, I'm not going to waste my time, or I haven't read it. So it's always startling to me, as someone that at least tries to be a free thinker, how someone could want to control what I'm able to see when they haven't seen it themselves.
Yeah. And a lot of these challenges that are coming through, it's very obvious that these books aren't being read. You'll see someone who challenges 50 books at once, and they just have the same reason across each one. It's very obvious they're not engaging with the material. And it's so important, just to go back on like why comics and keeping them in schools and libraries is so important, is, and this is showing that our society is so focused on the visual and we're turning more and more into using visual medias to express information. And so it's important for people as they're going through school to be learning how to navigate visual information and how to combine what they see with what they read. So we need to have the text, the image together, be able to look at it, think critically about what they're seeing, think critically about what they're seeing against the text that they're reading. So these are skills that are becoming more and more important, and it will be a deficit to folks if they're coming out to the world and they don't have that skill set. And, you know, and that can be seen, and maybe some of the people who are challenging this work who don't have those skills themselves and are misreading, misconstruing. That's been a huge thing with the challenges to genderqueer. Almost no one is getting the ages of the characters right. So it's like you're not even engaging at all with anything that's happening or going on.
At Project Censored, we're major advocates of critical media literacy education. And what you're hitting on right now are the multiple literacies, different types of literacies that are essential part of our educational structure and our educational system. And so when we see attacks on books, these are anti-intellectual movements. Often these are movements shaped and based by fear and or ignorance. And by the way, I don't want to downplay certain demographic concerns that people might have, with especially parents worrying about what their kids are exposed to. I mean, I'm not trying to belittle or downplay some people's concerns who have different value systems, different ideas about things. But I think, Jordan, you probably will agree that there's a line that's crossed when these folks try to start controlling what everybody else gets to do and see and think and be exposed to, and the types of education that they might be deprived of.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because that's a huge response. Some of the work we do is, you know, you can't tell us how to raise our kids. And it's like, no, you're absolutely right. I can't, and I shouldn't, and I'm not. We as a society need to respect that you are not going to tell other people what they're going to tell their children. So I'm glad that you brought that up, because that's a really good distinction, is we're not saying that people have to be reading this material. We're just keeping it from being removed. So the people who would like to have access to it and the people who could greatly benefit from the access have the access.
Absolutely. Jordan Smith, we have a few minutes left here in our segment. Again, we're delighted that you're joining us representing the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, where you're a digital editor. You also do freelance copy editing work and part of the Banned Books Week Coalition, of course. The Comic Book Legal Defense Fund site, cbldf.org, is an amazing resource. I want to make sure that we tell people that you can go there and see all of the resources. Of course, you can support them in different ways if you like. You have a tool to report censorship, which is very important. And you have an amazing library and educator tools section. And I just wanted to call attention to it, because it is so useful for educators, even for parents, just for people that want to understand what you do and why you do these things. So, Jordan Smith, in the couple minutes we have left, do you want to talk about what can people do to help support these efforts to keep books on shelves?
Definitely local organization is what is the most important and what gets the most done. So if you have the extra time and energy running for your school board, being involved in a library board, going to school board meetings and speaking for the material that you would like to be in your community. Those are all great ways. Also reporting. There's so many challenges, and I fear that we only know about the tip of the iceberg. So you can report to Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. You can also report to American Library Association, their Office of Intellectual Freedom. You can also report to National Coalition Against Censorship. So these are all organizations that have resources that can help fight book challenges. Just to mention one of our resources, we have adding fill in the blank graphic novel to your library collection. We list a lot of the things that can help fight against challenges, which are positive reviews about the books, any rewards they've won, and if they've been challenged in the past by other schools, some of the positive things about the book that were said at those challenges to help it be retained by that collection. So that's something you can look at to help as a starting place when you're defending books.
That is stellar information to have. Jordan Smith, you are digital editor with the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, cbldf.org. Anything else you want to leave our listeners with today, a place to follow you online or social media, or anything else you'd like to share?
I'd love to share two events that are coming up for the Banned Books Week. We're a member of the Banned Books Week Coalition. You can check out the calendar. There's tons of resources at bannedbooksweek.org. First event is a Comic Book Legal Defense Fund event. It's on Monday the 19th at noon Eastern Time. It's Gender Queer in Virginia, a case study. So we're going to be looking at the case in Virginia Beach with counsel on the case, breaking it down to see what happened, how it happened, why it happened, why the ruling was a great victory. And then later, Thursday the 22nd at 5 p.m. Eastern, we're going to have a panel, Censorship of LGBTQ plus Comics. And that will be Comic Book Legal Defense Fund co-moderating with PFLAG National, which I'm really excited about. So those are two events you can check out during Banned Books Week this September.
Jordan Smith from the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, cbldf.org. Jordan, thank you so much for taking time to join us on the Project Censored show today for Banned Books Week. Today, we're talking about all things Banned Books Week, and we are rounding out our show in conversation with Nico Perino. He is the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expressions Executive Vice President. Many of you may know Nico and his work from Mighty Ira, a civil liberty story. We've had Nico on the program before. He is also the creator and host of the Fires podcast. It's called So to Speak, the Free Speech Podcast. And prior to his current role, he led Fires Communications Department for nearly a decade, most recently as its senior vice president of communications. Nico has previously worked in the communications department at the Institute for Justice, and his writing has been featured in the USA Today, Politico, Newsweek, and The Guardian. He regularly travels and speaks about free speech and civil liberties issues, including at my own college, Diablo Valley College. Nico Perino will be speaking for Constitution Day on issues of academic freedom. And Nico Perino, welcome back to the Project Censored Show to talk about Banned Books Week.
Mickey, happy to be here.
So tell us about this shift in the name. Of course, the Fire is part of the Banned Books Week Coalition. The Fire, of course, known for its heroic support of academic freedom across the ideological spectrum, right to left. And this summer, Nico, you have expanded. So not just a foundation for individual rights in education, but for expression. Talk about that.
We wanted to keep the acronym FIRE, right? But we're no longer just in education. We are now doing free speech work beyond the higher education context, really for all Americans. And this has been a couple of years in the making. FIRE is 23 years old, and for most of our history, we've just done higher education work, free speech, academic freedom, due process, academic freedom. But we've been hearing over the years and actually seen the need in the larger society for an organization that provides an unapologetic defense for free speech in America writ large. And so we thought the moment was ripe to do that. We are not abandoning our campus work. In fact, we are doubling down and growing our investment and our programs in higher education, free speech, due process, and academic freedom advocacy. But now we are taking the message beyond campus, because what happens on campus doesn't stay on campus, and what happens off campus doesn't stay off campus. If you want to create a culture for free expression in America, there's really a need to fight for that culture off campus. And so this just gives us the capacity to do that. And we're going to do it in three main ways. We're going to do it through just a public awareness and education campaign. Some of your listeners might have seen our ads on television over the past couple of months since we announced our expansion June 6th. We're also investing in free speech research, so supporting scholars and an internal kind of mini think tank here at FIRE to research free expression issues and all its various permutations. And then, of course, to litigate off-campus issues. And we have just announced two of our initial off-campus representations. We're representing a resident in New York State who was blocked on Twitter by the New York State Senate Twitter account, which is unconstitutional. And we're also representing a volunteer-led autistic advocacy group named Neuroclastic. Now, they recently criticized a institution in the state of Massachusetts called the Judge Rotenberg Center, which still controversially uses electroshock therapy on its patients. And when Neuroclastic criticized this organization for doing so and put together kind of a research project that surveyed people in the behavioral sciences to figure out whether this is an appropriate method to use on autistic patients, they were served with a cease and desist letter from the lawyers at the Judge Rotenberg Center, alleging that they had defamed the center in their criticism. So we are representing Neuroclastic and happy to do so against what we see as a frivolous defamation suit that seeks to just bully a critic into silence rather than engage their critic in the court of public opinion.
So, Nick Operino, it sounds like the fire is spreading in a good way in this regard, the kind of work you're doing. And as you put it earlier, on and off campus, I mean, there's really not much of a distinction here. I mean, the rights of expression are important across the board. Banned Books Week, of course, is all about free expression. And this year, the theme is Books Unite Us, talks about how censorship is a tool of division. One of the things we see as a theme with banned books is the type of books that are challenged or banned. One of the things you have going on at the fire right now is you're challenging the Stop Woke Act in Florida about what professors can teach about race, sex, etc. Can you talk a little bit about the fire's work in that regard?
As I'm sure your listeners are aware, there are a number of bills and now laws across the country that seek to restrict the things that teachers can teach or even discuss in their classrooms. And in the higher education context, this is completely unconstitutional. Our institutions of higher education are there to foster debate, to produce knowledge, to explore new lines of inquiry. And if you shut down the conversation on certain topics before it even begins, you short circuit the knowledge producing vehicle that higher education is supposed to allow for. So Florida has one of the most restrictive of these laws. It seeks to ban certain discussions in higher education surrounding race and sex, and reaches so far as to say that there are certain materials, even if you're not advocating a certain perspective on those materials, just putting those materials in front of your students could run you afoul of the law. And so we're challenging that. We have a student at the University of South Florida and a professor at the University of South Florida who have joined us in that challenge. And we're seeking to just open up discussion so that higher education can serve the purposes that they are intended to serve. And we're optimistic that we'll win that fight in the court of law. But the lawsuit was just filed right after Labor Day.
Nick Operino, I wanted to point out too, we've had you on before. One of the issues that we see with academic freedom and matters of censorship is one side points at the other. The right points at the left and vice versa, so to speak, ideologically. And in the last couple of years, we've seen the rise of the phrase cancel culture come into play. Could you talk to our listeners a bit about the importance of opposing censorship, no matter where it comes from?
Freedom of expression, in certain part, is an insurance policy. It's the thing that protects us if we have an unpopular opinion, our ability to speak out, our ability to be who we are, and to speak our minds. And if you don't extend that same right to other people, even when you find their speech offensive or hateful, you can't really expect that that insurance policy, so to speak, will be there to protect you when you have something to say. And we see this all the time with censorship. In South Carolina right now, there's a bill winding its way, and I don't think it'll go anywhere, I hope not at least, that would restrict providing information about abortion in that state if that state were to make abortion illegal. Now, you could see a scenario, right, where abortion is legal in North Carolina but illegal in South Carolina, and merely visiting a website that tells you how to get abortion in North Carolina would become a criminal act. Telling someone that it's possible to get in an abortion in North Carolina would become a criminal act. So we put up billboards in the state of South Carolina saying that discussions surrounding abortion, they are free speech. And at the same time we were making that argument, we were fighting in the state of North Carolina against an effort by the student government at the University of North Carolina to defund and prevent funding to any student group that advocates a pro-life position. So in order to protect free speech for ourselves, we need to extend that same right to the people with whom we disagree. Otherwise, we're just hypocrites. You know, John Stewart once said that a principle ceases to be a principle if you don't apply it to everyone, and then it just becomes a hobby. We're seeing that to a certain extent in these book banning laws that are going through state legislatures. They're often passed by conservative legislatures who for years have argued for free expression, because they saw themselves as being the ones getting censored, whether it's in higher education, where you know student body and the faculty are predominantly liberal, or on social media sites. But now that they are on the ascendancy and they have control of these state legislatures, they're using censorship as a tool to impose their ideology against their political opponents. So I say we live in the age of the politics of expediency, whereby we cut down the branches of the law to get after our enemy. But that's a very short-sighted approach. And the reach of censorship has a way of boomeranging back at you. And so what we're trying to do at FIRE is just be that principled, even broker. For us, it's enough that the speech is protected. Our brand of civil liberties defense doesn't even opine on the content of the speech. We won't criticize the speaker, for example. We'll just say this is defended and here's why it needs to be.
You don't get lost in the weeds of a particular issue. You're focusing on the expression. You're focusing on not being hypocritical on free expression issues.
Free expression, we all understand intuitively that we want it for ourselves. I'd put it out to your listeners, who out there would trust someone else to determine for you what books you can read, for you what music you can listen to, you, for you what songs you can hear or speeches you can hear? Just asking yourself that question is to answer the question whether you're in support of free speech. But censorship presumes that there is someone out there with whom you would entrust the power to determine for you what books you can read. And I don't know. I think it's a core component of a free society that we don't give the authorities that power. Sometimes it puts you in difficult positions and you have to defend speech that you don't like. But for us, it's core that we protect that right for everyone. The Queen of England died, and there was a professor at Carnegie Mellon who tweeted about how she, because she perceives the Queen as being representative of the colonial empire that killed millions, she said, "I hope the Queen has an excruciating and painful death," or something to that effect. Well, Twitter took down her post, and there were concerns that Carnegie Mellon would remove her from her job because Jeff Bezos tweeted out something which amplified the tweet beyond probably the audience that would have already seen it, criticizing her for that. You know, Jeff Bezos is right to do so, but Twitter has a way of exercising double standards in determining what speech it decides to censor and what speech it doesn't. I mean, even if you look at the rule that it used to take down her tweet, which says something about how you cannot wish harm on other people, it says almost in the next sentence that in some cases, this might be okay. So it just leaves them full discretion to determine what they're censoring, what they're not. And if you're just an average American, you're asking yourself, if this is the new public square, is this really how it's going to operate?
Nico Perino, you bring up a good point that we bring up often at Project Censored, and that's censorship by proxy. Corporate censorship, big tech censorship is a real serious problem too. And then you have the problem with Jeff Bezos, owner of the Washington Post, supposedly a champion of the free press in theory, calling for punishments, calling for censorship. That's a very problematic element.
Well, you know, I don't know that he outright called for censorship, but the spirit is, you didn't have to do too much thinking to figure out where he was going with it. And I don't have the tweet in front of me, otherwise I'd read from it. It also kind of had Twitter's decision to censor the professor or take down her tweet also had created that sort of Streisand effect whereby the censorship results in more people seeing the message you're trying to censor. Censorship is a foolish enterprise in that sense as well. But I use it as a way to kind of illustrate that defending free expression, because I don't believe there's a huge audience for the professor's position that the Queen of England should have suffered through excruciating pain as she died. But I just use it to demonstrate that sometimes defending free speech means defending people who say things that you might disagree with, that you might hate. And that's to protect your right to do the same down the line, because I'm doubtful that there's any of us hold an opinion that someone out there doesn't disagree with or vehemently disagree with.
And so, Nico Perino, we're almost out of time for this segment. You're Executive Vice President at the FIRE Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. You recently talked about the case of Salman Rushdie, and Rushdie was stabbed, harmed greatly, threatening not only people's right to read, but authors' right to write and express and criticize.
There have been discussions in recent years whether this idea of Banned Books Week has become anachronistic. You know, they started calling it banned and challenged books because in the United States, our free speech culture had done away with the banning of books. Now, our previous discussions about what's happening in Florida elsewhere have proven that it's no longer anachronistic. Banned books, it's back, and it's back with a vengeance. And part of the reason it was maybe viewed as an anachronism is because Salman Rushdie's fight to publish the Satanic Verses goes back to 1989. And the fatwa that was issued against him, which essentially said that if you are a Muslim, you should seek out and kill Salman Rushdie, or at least under Ayatollah Khomeini's interpretation of the teachings. And so he went into hiding for 9 years. He actually wrote about this in his memoir of those years in hiding. Many people, dozens of people were killed. His book was banned in his home country. But after those 9 years, he felt that the free speech culture and the controversy had waned to the point that he could come out of hiding. And he actually spoke at FIRE's 20th anniversary gala. He was our keynote speaker. And we asked him, do you need security? And he actually said no. He felt safe in America and safe to live out his life. But as we learned in August, he wasn't safe when a man jumped on the stage and stabbed him multiple times, and he will hopefully survive. The right to speak, the right to bear witness to your beliefs, the right to artistic expression, those were all at stake in the Rushdie affair. And I'm afraid to say, I don't think America necessarily rose to the occasion in those early days and weeks afterward. I think we later come to recognize how important Rushdie's fight was. Banned and Challenged Books Week. It's definitely no longer an anachronism.
Nico Perino, there's so much